Hi, you're listening to Adrienne Barbeau and Quality Time Broadcast.
I'm just going to do it one more time.
Coffee can actually be tasted now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Burning.
You know what? A good scold is what really brings me to the forefront every day, personally. Like, that's the best part of waking up. We can all kind of
best
agree.
Part of waking up is getting a bad burn in your mouth. Oh, God damn it!
Oh, I'm so awake right now. Gosh. Oh, man. And you know what else I'm excited about? I'm excited because we're back for another episode of Quality Time, everybody.
Yay.
Still together after all these years.
I got to wind down a little bit.
You need me to take it down a little bit? I can take it down a little bit, boo. Is that better for you?
Yeah.
Is that cool?
That's so cool.
How about right here? Just a hair more?
She's so sensitive.
That's perfect.
All right, cool. Tight.
I think my hearing is better. It freaks me out. Everything I hear, I'm like, why are you screaming?
You're able to hear a mountain lion from like a mile away now. So my child must be protected.
Yeah.
The one thing that people don't know is that when you become pregnant, you actually get the senses of Wolverine.
Yeah.
And that pregnant lady you hear to my left is none other than the very lovely Kimberly Ambrose.
Hey
Kimmy, how's it going?
It better.
It do what it do. First of all, you got that look, though, that, like, I didn't go out all day.
Mm-hmm.
I had sweatpants on 90% of the time.
Yep.
I'm going to comb my hair before I leave the house.
I showered.
That's what it looked like.
At 4 p.m., 5 p.m. today.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice. How does it feel to be, how many months pregnant now?
I'm 19 weeks and a couple of days, I'm like 4 months.
So 4 months.
And then some.
What is it like being 4 months pregnant and probably a good 70% of the nation's population would still covet your body to have, like, of women?
I'd love to say, like, it's great and it's nice, but the taste of acidic backwash of just stomach acid in my throat just kind of takes away from that. You know, when I wake up and I don't feel good until like 1 p.m., like where I don't feel just terrible, it's kind of like, I don't give a fuck what anything looks like. My toenails are overgrown.
Yeah.
Not the only thing that's overgrown, to be honest. I can't with all this.
It sounded like a female commercial I heard this the other day. It's like, you know, I like being a woman, except for that acidic bathwash of vomit in my mouth every day.
Just lady things.
And that voice to my right is none other than my brother, Mr. Jeremy P. Woodworth. Jeremy, how are you, sir?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, is it Michael Caine? Is Michael Caine on the show again today?
That is insane. Tonight I am Donald Pleasance.
Donald Pleasance.
Insane in the Michael Caine?
The second British president.
I have worked with Michael Myers as his shrink for at least 20 years now. And all my work, he is the most insane fucker that will kill people on sight. He's definitely... I have failed as a psychiatrist, and why do I even do this? He's just an insane person. We should just kill him.
I do like the idea that Donald Pleasance, a.k.a. Dr. Loomis from Halloween, was so bad at psychiatry, he gave up. He disavowed trying to help people and went on one sole goal, which was to murder a young man. Like, that was his only purpose.
Have you ever seen the movie What About Bob?
I fucking
love that movie. But it starts with his therapist being like, I can't fucking do this anymore. Like, that's such a good way for a movie to start.
I was in Jaws.
Richard Dreyfuss.
I love that movie.
It really is fun. Baby steps to this.
Right.
It's a good odd couple.
I love when his wife tells him not to be snippy.
Yeah.
That's so good. I don't know why I love that so much.
I got a good thrill out of meeting Dreyfuss and telling him about him being on Star Wars tryout auditions on Saturday Night Live. It's like, yeah, they had you in like the C-3PO thing. And he said, I didn't want to wear the mask. So...
Yeah, I was in Jaws. I like because they have Daryl Hammond who plays him in SNL, and he makes him have like he over accentuates the Dreyfus lisp during that bit, and he's just like, "Hello, I am C-3PO, human cyborg relations." And oh man, the '90s SNL was pretty good, man. That was
pretty great.
One of my favorite.
Can I give my 2 cents towards the very very timely Ready Player One?
Yeah, so did you see Ready Player One?
Yes.
Have to say spoilers before any of this, or what?
I don't think I'm going to spoil too much of it, because I don't want to go too in-depth, but the things they did change take away from the love that a super uber dork geek like me loves about video games, so... But, you know...
What do you mean? The things they took away...
They took away from the video games and changed certain things that was like, okay... Completely unnecessary. You made it into a movie puzzle instead of a video game.
Oh yeah.
So instead of playing Tempest or Joust, instead we're watching a part of a movie from the 80s, and that's going to be one of the puzzles. So.
Oh, so it's just a different. They swapped references, yeah. And that's what you don't like about it.
Well, it's all supposed to be about video games, but the movie is just pretty much a giant masturbation about the 80s. So
okay, yeah. So I've heard some mixed reviews about it. I'm waiting to hear back from some other people to see if I'm going to see this. See, because I heard about Ready Player One, and I got to be honest with you, didn't move the needle for me, not even a little bit. I saw it, I was just like, this looks like a very uncreative piece of work that I see here. That's what it felt like to me. Now, I could be completely wrong. I've been proven wrong many times.
I've seen some kids at playgrounds that I feel that way about.
Yeah, like, fuck you and your Kanye West CD.
Didn't really catch the whole wind of intelligence there, did you, big guy?
Yeah.
Not doing much for me.
Hey, why don't you go play with those rocks over there?
That's definitely a movie that's made for like a 12-year-old, and at the same time, a person like me just loves it because it's all about the 80s and video games and popular culture. But at the same time, gosh, the things that they changed, like, why couldn't you just keep that? And I will give away one scene. I won't say where it is in the movie,
okay.
But it's in the guy's room, the mystic, you know, creator of the Oasis, which is like the reality that everybody lives in.
Yeah.
Is that his computer desk underneath it is just sitting a Commodore 64 with a disk drive that sounds like, oh, this Commodore 64.
Oh, look at that Commodore. Oh, I had all those electronics back then. Oh, God, what a magical, mystical time. Kimberly.
Jeremy, thou shalt not covet.
I heard I have a VIC-20. I don't have a Commodore 64 anymore. So.
Yeah, he doesn't ball like that anymore.
And once I actually hook it up, I really want to play Omega Race.
So. Yeah. Now, Kimberly, you had, you told me before the show that you had some disparaging words about a movie that I think Jeremy and I are pretty fond of. Would you like to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Okay, so I have no idea why. But today, my fiance and I started talking about the movie Get Out. And that it was because I had driven by the local movie theater by me, and I read all four, there's only four screens, and I read all four things on the marquee, and I didn't know any of them, and none of them sounded good, and I even felt like, Jesus, what is happening right now? Because the last one was called Sherlock Gnomes.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, I know what's happening here. This is an off year.
The new kids movie just came out.
There's there's always like a year where there just aren't really any movies that like
move
that
you
do
and
anything
stuff like that.
For you. Yeah, and like 2018 just seems like it's not getting there yet.
I don't know. Last the year before, I thought there were some good films out there.
The year before, sure, but
Get Out was in. I thought Get Out was fine.
And that's the point.
Three billboards.
That's
how
it came up. Was I said that's gonna this Academy Awards is gonna make Get Out be like the ultra nominated movie because nothing else really came out that challenged it. It's probably the best movie that's gonna come out of this year or last year. But my problem with Get Out is that we both watched it and at the end of it we were like, didn't do anything for me. Like I get what they were trying to say. And here's the thing that we came up with.
I thought that the best description of the movie, and I have to censor myself, but it was called the two-word description of what describes Get Out would be the Stepford N-words.
Yes, that's what he said.
A,
it's exactly like the Stepford Wives, right? It should be, okay, here's a cleaner version, the Stepford Wokes.
Yeah, the Stepford Wokes.
Because that's all it really is. It's just a liberal arts graduate wrote a movie. Uh-huh. And, you know, their college clearly paid for by their parents, and they want to tell everybody else how to think and feel. And I'm on their side. I get the message mm-hmm. of the movie. But I hate in a movie, I really can't stand when, like, in James Bond or something like that, when the bad guy is pointing a gun at the person you're rooting for, and they take like 4.5 minutes to explain like their plot line and what they were gonna do and what did happen, and then they did this and that, because I get mad, because I'm like, that's the movie. Show me that part.
Yeah.
Why are you saying all of this? Just show me that. So like with Get Out, I would have rather seen them making the white people into black people, into the zombies. Instead, there was this whole ending where they were like, oh, psych, we're evil, gotcha. And by the way, she's actually white inside, and he's actually white inside. Yeah. And I was like, but why are they saying that? Like, it's so boring. Like, if you were to take, here's what I was saying earlier to him, was like, take the synopsis of Get Out and explain it to me, right? Okay. It's about a black guy who goes to a white people's house, and he's secluded. He can't drive. That's pretty scary by itself.
Yeah.
And then he finds out these like black people are basically white zombies. That's a scary idea.
Yeah.
Okay, now take the movie Rear Window. Explain that synopsis. Guy in a wheelchair thinks he sees a murder. That movie visually is scarier than all of Get Out.
So I hear what you're saying.
Right.
I'm hearing it.
Right.
I think it sets back black and white relations by decades, because try to build up a trust to actually get your white daughter to go out with a black guy and she sees this crap. Never gonna give white people a chance again.
You know what would have been scarier too? If the daughter wasn't in on it. If we could have had her fear register with his fear. If she would have been like, oh, what the fuck is going on? Like, that would have also been scarier.
Well, I think it's just, it's just refreshing to walk into a movie and know that as a white male, I'm going to be the safest person no matter what happens. You know,
finally,
I thought it was good. I was like, I like the idea of like shitting on white people in a sense that this is how black people are.
I always,
you know,
love that.
We're always, there's tons of movies about white people that go into the hood. There's Death Wish, where he goes and fucking takes back the streets of New York from the street criminals and stuff like that. And you know, movies like Trespass, you know, where it's two honkies that wander into the hood and they get in way over their heads, right?
Ruh-roh.
So this is like it's that flipped. It flips that around. This is what it's like for black people to be around all white people. It's scary.
And I get that. And I love it. And I wish it would have been executed better, because here's an example I made, right? Have you ever seen the original House on Haunted Hill?
Yeah, many years ago, but yes.
There's a scene, and okay, for those who haven't seen it, for the listener, it's black and white.
Spoiler
no,
alert.
No pun intended.
Do you think we have to do a spoiler before
starring
we...
Starring Vincent Price.
Talk about this 1960s
movie.
Jeremy,
what movie did that come out, do you think? Like 63?
I'm thinking maybe 58.
Yeah, so black and white, women are still wearing dresses, not allowed to vote, whatever. And there's a scene where a lady and a guy find themselves in the basement. It's totally innocent. Again, this is like the 50s, right? So there's no like teens making out. It's just like they're walking around. I think they even have candles, like, and they're trying to find something, or they're creeping around in this creepy old house.
And they're smoking 24/7 and blowing smoke into their face while they're kissing.
And she can't walk anywhere unless a man's is holding her arm for some reason.
Finally.
He keeps laying jackets down for her to walk over. I don't know why.
Even if it's an acid bath.
Yeah. But there's a scene in this movie where there's like two doors, and he goes in one and she goes in another, and it closes behind her and she's terrified, but she's got this candle and there's nothing in this little like closet space, and she backs up and backs up and backs up, and she walks right into, I'm not kidding, a haunted house style old lady with her fingers up in scary mode with old lady face,
moving on like a trolley too, because she like, it looks like she's like floating. It's really creepy.
It literally is like a haunted house cheesy thing, and I jump. I've seen it like 4 times. I jump every time, and I laugh because I'm like, God damn it! Like, this is the cheesiest fucking thing.
I shouldn't hate this.
But it's so good. It's such a good jump scare. It's so cheap. I feel like Get Out totally walked away from all of the basic horror things. Like, how do you make a movie about the fear that black people have experienced, but totally didn't talk about, like, the visceralness of the Wes Craven aesthetic, like whippings and lynchings and being dragged places. Like real life is scarier than what Get Out was trying to do.
Truthfully, I think it's audience, when you think about, what is it, Jordan Peele, right? He wrote and directed the movie.
Yes.
I think he went in with the mentality, he was just like, I think people know this background. I think they come in, and I think in 2018, we were expected to walk into the movies with the background already figured out. That's why they make new Spider-Man movies, and we don't have to watch the origin story
anymore.
And
that's fine, but then don't call it a horror movie. Call it a suspense thriller.
I think it is more of a suspense thriller.
That's all I'm saying.
But the genre of horror, I think it's more important to be classified as horror because movies that big, you know, Silence of the Lambs, that's a suspense thriller, right?
Yes.
No matter how much. But it's important to be classified in horror because I think it's bigger for the genre in general, and it brings that to the forefront. And suspense thrillers, I mean, there's a lot of shitty ones out
there. Right.
I think to lump it in with, like, the best of horror, it shares those scary elements, and it's important to be part of it. And, you know, I think it does all the right things. I mean, if you consider The Stepford Wives a horror movie, then this is a horror movie too. It's, if you consider Invasion of the Body Snatchers, same kind of premise. It's not that it hasn't been done. It's just a little bit blacker. It's just a little bit cooler.
It's not the blackness. I love the blackness. It's the fact that I didn't end watching that movie and go, I'm gonna fucking lose sleep tonight.
Oh, no, I don't think it's scary in that sense.
That was my problem. Like, why is this called a horror movie? It's a PSA.
I don't know. But then again, also, I feel like as a white person, maybe I'm not going to relate to it the same way a black person. It's the same thing with Black Panther, right? I saw Black Panther, and I watched it, and I thought it was a good movie. But it doesn't mean the same thing that it means to the black people across the fruited plains.
You know what's scarier? You know what's visually scarier that left a scarier impact on me? Fucking Roots.
Roots
is way scarier.
Well, because
he's getting whipped and told his name isn't what it. I mean, that's fucking terrifying.
I think that's where white guilt came from. Was this miniseries Roots?
You know what I say? Good.
I hate to say that when you were talking about what scares black people, I kind of envisioned you at a focus group in a big room full of black people, just asking, "What scares you as black people? Tell us. Write down what scary things are to black people."
I don't want to speak for anyone, but if I could just guess, Trump, anyone that aligns with Trump,
torches scare you.
Anyone who doesn't know who the fuck Emmett Till is, that's scary. That's fucking terrifying.
You know what? The white version, the white equivalent to the movie Roots, and something that's really affected me over the years is actually the movie The Ten Commandments. Like, anytime I see an Egyptian person, I think, you know, fucking Egyptian devils, okay? They enslaved our people for years and years.
And I just can't get over it.
And I still haven't gotten it. Personally, I haven't gotten over it. And I think they need to, you know, give the pyramids to white people.
I'm not Christian, but it's like too soon. Okay.
You know, the aliens' buildings. They belong to the white people build them.
I was gonna say the movie Zulu with Michael Caine. So.
Oh, they knew it. Michael Caine Zulu.
Which literally was the scariest moment for any Englishman of all time, which is like 10 to 20,000 black people versus like 100 white guys. So
you said, I like that you brought up Trump. I wrote this joke. I don't have anywhere to stick it in, like my greater act as I'm working on it and stuff like that. But I had this idea, like, do you think right now, like, everybody thinks like Barron Trump is this kind of weird, possibly autistic kid. But, like, do you think really what he's doing is nightly going back in time with Doc Brown and the DeLorean and trying to stop Donald from finding the sports almanac? I feel like that's really what he's up to this whole time. He's like, God, you know what, Dad? I don't really know about this. And he's like, here's your mother, Ivanka. I'm like, my mom! He just woke up into this world where Donald Trump is president and he has to go back and fix it.
I don't think he's autistic. I think there's just nothing expected.
There's a big video. There's lots of like articles written that like Donald, that fucking Barron Trump is autistic. sick because of the way he acts on camera
really?
And stuff like that. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he would be terrified, right? I mean, he's a little kid. He's in the spotlight. His dad is cold.
That's what I like. I take it all as that. I'm like,
yeah.
People on the internet, just chill. Leave
well,
this
here's,
poor
here's
boy
a good
alone.
Example, right?
I did a good joke, okay? But
yeah.
All the rest of you, don't... Don't make jokes about little kids.
Well, here's
okay?
a good example, right? Like when you see someone on camera, like in court, and they are told like horrible things about this crime, you know, a murder that they're, you know, I was just listening to the last podcast on the left. They were talking about Casey Anthony, and they were mm-hmm. saying like her reactions,
fucking sexiest
were not,
fucking murderer in the world.
Right. That's a guilty MILF I'd fuck anyway.
Gosh, the only time I've ever jerked off to True TV.
Yeah, right. Every time they say sperm, whip it out.
Yes!
But like they were talking about her reactions and like her lack of reactions. And then when they said not guilty, she didn't really react. And it's like, but grieving has its own. You can't say how someone should grieve. So it's the same thing. He's a child.
Yeah, some people don't like to cry in front of people. And so
honestly,
you like
his
to be
family,
private with it.
His family doesn't appear to be very like close, I guess.
Yeah.
How he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, you know.
Fuck all the haters.
I guess what we're getting at is that Casey Anthony's really misunderstood, guys.
Connects.
More than anything.
Not what I'm getting at. I won't stand by that. She murdered that child.
I like that we have been getting a lot of positive feedback. By the way, I do have some Joe Robinson corrections. Really only one. One is from my wife, a correction from the Con Air episodes.
Okay.
One was from Con Air episode one, where we mistakenly said... we didn't. How do I live mm-hmm. without you? Who sings that?
Trisha Yearwood.
Yeah,
Shania Twain.
We said the wrong one. It was Trisha Yearwood.
No, yeah. I think Rob said it after.
Yeah, so we fucked that up. And then Joe Robinson texts me as he's listening to the episode. He goes, "A half episode, really? That's what we get." He was just like, "I was at like 6 minutes left in it, and I saw it running down. I was like, man, how are they going to finish this?" And then you fucked me. So
it was a personal vendetta.
That was our one Joe. That was our Joe Robinson shout out.
And
so.
we didn't introduce our Patreon thing where you get to hear a whole episode as
yes.
opposed to non-paid.
Yeah, we just hold the second part on in hostage behind a paywall.
All you gotta do is pay us $150
a month
and then we'll give you an entire episode.
No, we'll do nothing extra. I need to be clear with that. We're not going to do any more work. We just will have your money, and then
you'll get an email confirmation saying we have your money.
Yeah.
I'll take a couple
selfies with your cash. Yeah. I'll show you can watch me go to Target and spend it at other local eateries.
Yeah.
These are Clams Casino. Thanks, you know, fucking Mac Bergson.
You can watch me write a mortgage check.
Yes. Look, this
live.
Is my you actually technically own this corner of my house right now.
Thank
it's
you.
This little 12-foot corner is now.
I wanted to go out and make sure that we don't get sued. And apologize
like,
to.
I like that Jeremy thinks he can be the legal counsel for us. This is already going great.
well, of course, I made a joke that James Finn was really racist.
Yeah, so James Finn commented that he's like, can I just go through one episode without being called a blatant racist?
No, I'm sorry, it's done now.
Can't.
Your fate has been decided.
I mean, if you don't know who James Finn, obviously making that joke was very funny to me, and of course, if you don't know him, I'll apologize that anybody gets like an opinion of him, and I just want to say personally, James Finn, I'll see you at the meeting, wink wink.
Woo! Alright, Jeremy, doubling down on the racism of James Finn. I like it. It was a good payoff after we got through all. He's so tickled right now. He's literally keeled
over. He had to
lay
back. He couldn't even contain himself.
But I think that brings us one quick last little shout out. By the way, if all our quality timers out there, we just want to say from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for tuning
thank
in
you.
To another episode. We really do love it. If you are listening to the show, and I know you're listening, I see the downloads. Do us a kindness, okay? It would mean the world to us
mm-hmm.
if you just hopped on the Stitcher or the iTunes where there's a rating system. Give us a 5-star rating. If you do, we'll read it on the show. And we would just love your input on it and support in that for this free show that we produce for you mm-hmm. every week. It would just mean... Kimberly, tell them how much it would mean the world to us.
I feel like... pretend someone brought you like something as simple as a Hershey kiss, and you were like, oh my God, that really brightened my day. And then they pulled out a bowl of mac and cheese with like ground beef in it. And you were like, what? You just stepped up the fucking game. Okay, imagine that escalation of feeling. That's what we feel.
Nice.
When you give us a 5-star rating, we want to give you like a whole cheesecake, because that's, we won't, but we want to. That's how we feel.
It means that much to us. Yeah. So go out there, leave one on iTunes, leave one on Stitcher, either of those platforms. If you use something else, that's weird.
Drop
I
those
don't
5-star ratings like goose turds, bro.
Do that shit to us. And hey, do us a favor. Word of mouth spreads it better than anything. We don't have money to pay for advertising. Tell a friend. Thank you.
Use your mouth to spread quality time. Put your mouth on someone, probably their genitals, anything that feels good, really. Yeah. And while you're down there, just be like, have you heard quality time? Blah, blah, blah. And just get in there. Right. Just get in there. And while they're riding up and down through the roller coaster of ecstasy, they'll be like, gee, what the fuck is quality time? They'll want to know. They'll seek it out.
I dig that. Well, that brings us to tonight's episode, ladies and gents.
It's a fucking doozy.
It's 1981's classic.
Metal Gear Solid.
John Carpenter's Escape from New York.
Oh, is there such thing as like a movie being your alma mater?
Yeah, I don't know. I get a lot of warm and fuzzies from this one.
God, I love this movie so much.
Now, in my Mount Rushmore of this is easily in my Mount Rushmore of John Carpenter films right here, because he's made a lot of my favorite movies.
He's amazing,
hands down. And this is, I'd say this makes the Mount Rushmore. What do you say, Jer?
Of Carpenter films?
Of Carpenter's films.
It doesn't make my top four.
It doesn't. This doesn't make your top four
for Carpenter.
For Carpenter, yeah.
The Fog is better than
no,
this to me.
No, The Fog is not better than this.
Dude, the manly pauses that take place in Escape from New York, the longer they pause, the manlier it feels.
It makes my top 10. It doesn't make my top four.
Oh, it definitely makes my top four. I go Thing. I go The Thing. I go They Live. I go Escape from New York. And then I go, I mean, I want to say Halloween. I guess I have to go Halloween, right? Halloween.
I remember that.
I feel like you have to.
I remember I pissed you off something fierce the other year when I said that Halloween. I was like, it's so dated. I don't even care about it. And you're like, you really, really insulted me personally because I didn't like Halloween. I was like, dude, it's been around forever.
It's a groundbreaking piece of cinema. You know, I got into a really big discussion with some people on the horror boards in the horror groups that I'm in, and about what was better, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Halloween. And I was like, oof, I mean, it's a tough toss-up. I mean,
that's hard.
Carpenter makes a more beautiful movie in Halloween. I'll tell you that.
That's
it's a more
like
beautiful
saying,
movie to watch, but God damn it, the fucking atmosphere in Texas Chainsaw Massacre is
so good.
It's kind
of like saying, what's more American, baseball or football? Like, it's just too hard to argue.
It is. I went ultimately with Texas Chainsaw, though.
Okay.
But that's just me.
Okay.
And the grittiness and the 16mm of it versus Dean Cundey's really smooth cinematography. You know, it's a whole different movie altogether, but the grittiness adds to it, so.
No, I agree with that. I like the grittiness, Jer. I like the grittiness.
I hate to say one of my four might actually be Dark Star.
Dark Star? I respect that more because that's his first movie, so I respect that a little bit more from you.
And I hate to say one of my four might be even Cigarette Burns. So
now here's a fun trivia question to start it off. Now, The Fog and this movie share two particular actors that are in both of these movies. Jeremy, can you name them?
Is it Harry Dean Stanton? Harry?
No, obviously Adrienne Barbeau.
Okay, Adrienne Barbeau is one.
Yeah.
Now where's the other actress
Amazing
that's in The Fog
boobies.
In this?
The actress. In The Fog. How many actresses were there? Other than Jamie Lee Curtis.
No, this is an actor. The other actor. There's an actor and an actress. You've got Adrian
Barbeau. Obviously Tom Atkins.
Now, here's another fun little tidbit. In both of these movies, neither of their characters meet. Neither Adrian Barbeau's character meets Tom Atkins' character in either The Fog or this movie.
Wow.
They're just both in it, and it's like, they could have never met each other at all. They just have been in multiple films and just have never interacted with each other.
Isn't that something that won't fill my gas tank? Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So this movie dropped in... Oh, I got my other notes here. Let me open my real notes here.
While you do that, can I just say, this movie has a very long opening. like it's just credits with a song, and the song is cool. So like I felt like it was like very sultry. Like it started off like wooing you in, but then it went on too long. So it felt like you were watching an SNL sketch of the Continental, where it's like it starts off like he's a gentleman.
Yeah.
You're being wooed, but then you're like, this just got awkward. It's going on too long.
Well, you have to really appreciate the Carpenter makes you appreciate the cinematography and the music and the setting. He lets you get right in. I find if you take a little sweet puff of that chi before you sit down in it and let it really sink and wash over you. I know that's hard to say to you right now. I know that's hard to say to you. But it makes it much more enjoyable.
I can see, definitely. I feel like he doesn't want this to be called a movie. He'd prefer it to be called a film.
Yes, yes. Now, John Carpenter was inspired by the movie Death Wish in 1974 by this movie. Not necessarily the film's philosophy, but he liked how it conveyed a sense of New York City as a kind of jungle. And he wanted to make a science fiction film along those same lines. There were a lot of actors that were considered before they settled on Kurt Russell, including Chris Christopherson, Nick Nolte.
They just wanted great hair.
Chuck Norris.
Oh, wow.
Chuck Norris, Jeff Bridges.
Oh, my God.
But Carpenter really wanted Clint Eastwood, to play this part.
That
Charles Bronson?
Charles Bronson was also considered, but Carpenter wasn't on board with them because he thought he was too old, but yet he thought it was okay to have Clint Eastwood, which is kind of weird because
I think the worst is Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones was also considered for this part.
I love Tommy Lee Jones.
I do. I think Tommy Lee would have brought a good vibe to this, but the fact that Clint Eastwood was desired the most to star in this movie is interesting because Kurt Russell's inspiration for Snake was Clint Eastwood.
That makes sense. I can see that.
It was just a little tidbit. There's
a lot
there.
Of him like sticking his jaw out, you know, and like gritting his teeth.
Now, one other little fun fact before we jump into the play-by-play of this movie. This is also co-directed by Nick Castle. And you might know Nick Castle. Well, Nick Castle's major contributions to this movie were that he wrote into the character Cabby, played by Ernest Borgnine, who we'll get to later.
Love him.
And he also wrote the ending to this movie.
Oh.
So this ending, which we will get to, is completely Nick Castle's doing. And Castle had worked with Carpenter one time before this, and it was on the movie Halloween in 1978. Can you guess who he played in that movie?
Nick Castle. God, yeah. I'm just gonna throw some words out. A rape victim.
No.
I'm gonna say
a store clerk.
Main monster in Halloween.
Yes, he plays Michael Myers.
Oh wow.
He plays Michael Myers in the first Halloween movie.
We don't know that he's not a rape victim, but that's fine.
No, we don't know that. We don't know that. So the movie opens up to narration and a computer's voice giving you the prologue to the movie. And I'll just go ahead and play this here. And while you're listening along, Jeremy, don't step on this. Little trivia. Try to guess what uncredited actress is saying the intro here.
Okay.
The crime rate in the United States rises 400%. The once great city of New York becomes the one maximum security prison for the entire country. A 50-foot containment wall is erected along the New Jersey shoreline, across the Harlem River, and down along the Brooklyn shoreline. It completely surrounds Manhattan Island. All bridges and waterways are mined. The United States Police Force, like an army, is encamped around the island. There are no guards inside the prison, only prisoners and the worlds they have made. The rules are simple. Once you go in, you don't come out.
Now.
Can I just say, 1988, though, when they were talking about this whole shit started, Year of the Dragon, motherfucker, that's when I was born.
Yeah, bitch.
I came in this world, and the crime just went up. People just... And can I say, you know, the New York, 1997 New York that they portray in this movie, not too far off the real New York in 1997.
It was pretty wild in there.
It was scary.
It was pretty wild.
It was a scary time.
The funny thing is, if you watch the old David Letterman's from the 90s when he was still in New York, it's still, well, he was in New York, but he changed locations, but it still kind of looked like the Baltimore block with like strip joints right in the middle of Times Square and dirty,
yeah,
and still look filthy where it looks like Disneyland now.
It really was Giuliani, yeah, that took, yeah, charge of that and was like, nope, this has to be a tourist spot. We have to have this safe.
We're going to shake down all these fucking black people until they're out of our town. That's pretty much... So Kimberly, any guess of who did that narration at the beginning
there? I'm going to guess Sigourney Weaver.
It sounds a lot like her, and you almost can think it. But no, Jeremy, can you correct her on this?
Was it an actress that I mentioned before and almost spoiled it? Maybe, yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis?
It was Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, dang, son.
Jamie, yeah, Lee Curtis, who's uncredited in this movie for this.
Typical.
There is another person who's is credited in this movie, but his name is messed up. There is a screen painter who painted a lot of the sets here. Just this little unknown actor.
He's somebody you definitely would know as one of the biggest directors of all time.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in the credits, he's known
Sam Raimi.
No, he's known as Jim Cameron in the credits.
Oh, so, Jimmy Cameron. Oh. So this is definitely after the Terminator, though.
Yeah, I guess it is after Terminator.
What year is this?
81. So Terminator's 83.
Way before Terminator.
Yeah, so this is little Jim Cameron working on this film. Another interesting tie to this movie, just a little tidbit, a very young teenager actually got to watch this movie before it came out, and because his dad worked at the studio and suggested that Adrian Barbeau's death scene, spoiler alert.
sorry.
It wasn't established well enough, so they had to go back and do a reshoot because of his suggestion. This unknown teenager at the time grew up to be J.J. Abrams.
Oh,
so,
wow.
A lot of good ties from this movie.
And that was the last good directorial decision that J.J. Abrams ever made.
Whoa. If you like to see rehashed Steven Spielberg films, J.J. Abrams is your man. Yeah. Hands down.
I had to go back to your Mount Rushmore of Carpenter.
Yeah.
And I would probably put Christine and Starman there. So.
Starman, I mean, it's like Academy Award winning movie.
I feel like you need a fucking huge mountain for this Rushmore, Jeremy. At this point, it's like seven movies.
By the way, I actually wanted to go see John Carpenter live because he comes and performs like his music at theaters and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Guess how much a ticket was to go see John Carpenter?
Let me guess. Like $250.
That's exactly what it was.
I am good at money sometimes.
Why?
I think you're thinking about Tim and Eric.
Is probably cheaper.
Yeah, I would say cheaper. But $250 against me,
that's a lot.
I mean, I almost have justified enough that I want to see Book of Mormon for that much. But now
I would see Book of Mormon for that.
I would see it for that. But now, but to see just John Carpenter's old ass up there with that?
I don't know.
Wait till we get to Big Trouble in Little Chinatown and we'll explain why that $250 ticket is way overpriced. So it opens. The opening scene, we get to see the wall. We get to see the helicopter flying above New York City. You'll actually see a stat of the Statue of Liberty as the helicopter flies by. That's actually the only one of two shots that was actually filmed in New York City.
Huh.
That was it. Everything else was filmed in St. Louis or California. Most of the city shots, like the majority of the movie is filmed in St. Louis.
I was going to say that all the really bad scenes of the inner city were filmed in Detroit after a basketball game.
Yes.
I had to get that joke out early. So.
As we see the helicopter flying, we see two cons trying to, in a makeshift raft, heading for the wall. They're worn, and then they are blown up by the chopper, blasted with missiles.
And this is just
cool.
When Kim Ambrose gets so happy. This, you understand? Like,
yeah.
I've seen nothing but like a futuristic plot line started, the music. It's a John Carpenter movie. We're going to see Kurt Russell, and a helicopter exploded. Like, my dick is just hard at this point.
So we see
and when Kim's dick gets hard, she has children.
So we established that the Statue of Liberty Island is actually the security control for Manhattan there. That's where all of we meet Tom Atkins' character Remy. He is at the control board, and he's getting confirmation that the two were taken out on the raft. Shortly after there, we see our hero, Snake Plissken, played by the very lovely, very handsome Mr. Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Can I give a little trivia about Tom Atkins?
Yes, please.
The only actor or celebrity I've met in person that I felt a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, was he just strong?
Getting a little touchy with the hand on the back. So.
Oh, he was ready to head to Fucktown, huh? Nice.
You know, if it's like Paul Rubens, you expect, you know, some little funniness because, you know, he's funny.
Yeah, but you
weren't. With Tom Atkins, I was like, ah.
Yeah, because he has that demeanor that says, I could probably rape you, too, right? Like, Tom Atkins could probably hold you down.
He saw a rape clown and was like, ooh, a treat.
And the ultimate taking out of my childhood was meeting Gore Duvall, who otherwise known as the DC 20 late night horror guy who dressed up like it's Dracula. And I've been holding this back, but this is like a real tidbit of joy for
let
me.
Let it out, Jerry.
He's looking
let
real. He looks like he's 80 years old now. Okay. He looks like he's really old. And when the last time I saw him at Horrified up in wherever the last Horrified was, I see him with maybe a 60-year-old chick that's working at the hotel. And getting their picture to taking together, he's getting kind of friendly with her, and to watch him do like a total grab ass on this chick, I was like, wow, this is my childhood. Watching him totally do a feel up on this other woman, I was like,
So your fondest memory is a sexual assault.
Sounds
it wasn't
woman,
assault
right?
Because it was very much, okay. It was very much, you know, she was happy with it. So
sure, that's what
well,
he said.
Happiness outside, questionable inside. You know.
Well, there wasn't a slap, so.
A smile is not consent, okay?
So, next we see Plissken being escorted into the building in cuffs. A speaker overhead informs him that he has the option to be terminated and cremated. Just let your officer know. Otherwise, next stop is Manhattan Jail in 2 hours.
That's how we welcome people to the funeral home.
Yeah, next stop, get cremated. Turn them and burn them, bitches. Remy, meanwhile, is outside having a smoke when a limo pulls up, and that's where we meet Hulk, who is played by Lee Van Cleef. I remember Lee Van Cleef most fondly from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He's the bad guy from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right on.
Great film.
Total man
Never
stuff.
Heard of it before.
Remy tells him that there is a unidentified jet flying nearby. They head to the control room and they hear a message of a lady saying, "We're going to crash." Then they realize that this plane is Air Force One.
Oh my God, what?
With the British president.
First of all, the premise of this movie is already getting to fever pitch levels. We've already introduced, there's a giant fucking prison that New York City is now just a giant prison where they let the fucking animals go wild in there. And then we hear the Air Force One is about to crash. Boom. Fucking double style taken on this movie.
It's like Hotel California. You can enter, but you can never leave. And see, at this point in the movie already, this is when my neighbors have to knock on my door and ask us to turn the happiness down because they can hear us. You understand?
I get it.
So much joy.
So here's this little clip of the plane going down at the opening segment of Escape from New York.
Tell this to the workers when they ask where your leader went. We, the soldiers of the National Liberation Front of America, in the name of the workers and all the oppressed of this imperialist country, have struck a fatal blow to the racist police state. What better revolutionary example than to let their president perish?
This scene, I'm going to stop it right there.
Doing great. I'm getting through that door, I got
to
say.
Do you see that guy trying to break through the door here on Air Force One?
Trying is a big word for that, what he was doing.
That actually is a semi-famous person right there. That gentleman trying to break through the door is the son of none other than President Gerald Ford.
Stop
right
it.
That's Stephen Ford.
Stop
trying
it.
Trying to break through the door of Air Force One.
And he's not wearing a safety helmet, so.
When I... So he's breaking the law, so he should be arrested. When I watch this scene and she's giving this militant terrorist speech. Mm-hmm. It made me think of in Blazing Saddles when the teacher goes up to give that mm-hmm. speech and she's like all quiet and they're like, we can't hear you, speak louder. And she's like, I'm sorry, I'm just not used to public speaking. We the white people of the, and they're like, yes. Jesus fucking God. Christ, lady. Yeah.
The thing I couldn't stop thinking of when I saw this scene, I was just like, great, another super woke white liberal lady.
Oh,
yeah.
All I was thinking is like her followers are like, wait a second, I thought we were part of the front liberation front of America. No, we're the front liberation front of the, damn it, I'm in the wrong group.
You idiot.
She thinks she's better than you because she bought a Prius, but she still spends $6 at Starbucks every day. Like, bitch, you're not any better than me.
Well, let's check out the rest of the scene real quick so we can hear our British president.
Unlock the pod. She's bolted the door.
The Tide Pod?
Can't you shoot off the lock?
No, sir. She's pressurized the cabin.
How about lifting the door off of the hinges?
No, sir.
Straps a briefcase to his arm. Handcuffed. And our second British president after George Washington, Donald Pleasance, gets into an escape pod.
This is a locating device to trace you if you become
the first iWatch ever.
So, let me stop you right here. Like, I love that we're really getting to see this high-tech 80s technology, yeah. Or 1997
yeah.
technology.
Future.
Let me put this tracker on you. He literally straps a fucking Game Boy to yeah. his wrist, okay? Yeah. This thing is fucking huge. And then inside, he has like a colored Vectrex that's on like the hatch of this plane.
It's got the readouts of multiple people's blood pressure from like a nursing home all on one screen.
Does this touch upon the conspiracy theories people that have about this being three to 4 years before the actual hitting of the Twin Towers with a plane?
Technically, I mean, it would be 4 years because it's 1997. Right. So, yes, it is before 9/11. But we haven't even talked about the Twin Towers yet.
We'll get there,
it's
yeah.
coming in. Right. It's all one part of one big right. conspiracy that we're getting to, Jeremy.
Of course.
So the Secret Service agents, of course, try to break down the door, but it's going down. So they stick Donald Pleasance, a.k.a. the president, into the pod and this red egg-shaped pod. And then the plane goes down. They all of a sudden scramble a team for a recovery team to head into Manhattan, and the squad finds the president's pod vacant. But they do hear laughter, and a small man that looks a little bit like Steve Buscemi fucked the white guy from Prodigy appears. This is the only other audio clip that I prepared until the end, but I prepared this guy. This is, I forget, what is this character's name? It's Roman or something like that?
I don't know, but I'm going to say that how many years of New York being a prison, and everybody looks as if they're a character from a Billy Idol video. So.
Yeah, so look how he just walks up.
They touch me, he dies. If you're not in the air in 30 seconds, he dies. If you come back in, he dies.
The president's finger.
A finger. We don't know if it's the president's.
19.
Dude, you want a finger? I'll get you a finger.
17.
Fucking amateurs.
16.
Let's go.
They back off and they head back to the island, right? Next we see Hulk sitting down at his desk and Snake enters. He starts talking to him. He goes, Snake Plissken, Special Forces, youngest man to ever be decorated by the president, robbed a Federal Reserve depository, life sentence. I'm ready to kick your ass out of here, World War Hero.
Okay.
Ready to kick your ass out of the world, War Hero. And he essentially gives him an ultimatum and an offer. But it's an offer you really can't refuse. He says he has to go rescue the president from New York,
mm-hmm.
or from the max security prison. And
president of what?
Snake has 22 hours to get the president and the briefcase out so that he can go to the Harper Summit meeting. Now, inside there's a tape recording in the briefcase that has to reach the summit in 22 hours, essentially hopefully preventing World War III is what it sounds like.
No, like, that's not what it sounds like to me. What it sounds like to me is pretend you're a 12-year-old boy and you wrote a script for a movie. There's a meeting. There's a briefcase. We're on a time crunch. You're a dude. Fucking do it.
And he's got this highly technological cassette tape.
Yes, yes, yes. Also, I'd like to point out the two things. First of all, I'm pretty sure the first words that Kurt Russell speaks in this movie are, "Call me Snake." That's fucking awesome. It's such a buildup. He gets to this desk. He's got cuffs on. He's like, "I wouldn't mind fucking kicking you out of the whole world, motherfucker." And all he said, he's like, "Call me Snake."
And the worst part is he's not proud of his family Jewish name, Pliskin.
Yeah, so. At all.
Oh, man.
The other thing I'd like to point out is that when they were walking him to the office, they walked him by a sign, and the sign said something about, like, follow the orange line, like, don't talk back, like, blah, blah, blah. Basically saying, yeah, we already know you want to fuck with us, not in your best interest to do that.
Yeah.
But they did one of my favorite things in movies with this sign. They give you enough time to read it, and you read it, and then they linger long enough for the stupid cucks who came to see this movie to catch up. You know what? Like, you have enough time to read it
Stop.
Two and a half times.
I had to rewind it.
Yeah.
I prefer watching the cucks version, so.
So, on top of that, just to make sure that he makes it back in this 22-hour time frame, he injects two small explosives into Snake's neck.
They really pulled a fast one.
Yeah, what a dick move. They were like, here, they literally pulled like the classic, like, take the dog to the vet move. Like, hey, buddy, we're just going to take you to the park over here. Hey, what are those things?
Oh, did you need those balls?
Oh, sorry about that, Snakey Poo. We just put two little explosives in your neck, just enough to blow up your arteries and kill you instantly.
It's kind of cool. He goes, the cat. Capsules will start dissolving, and I was like, mm-hmm. And they go, and then there's a core of the capsule, and I was like, go on, I can see it. And he says, and by the time the core dissolves, what? It's gonna explode in your arteries. So it's not so dramatic that it's gonna make his head explode. It's just he'll be talking to someone and his neck is going to have two small explosions and he's going to hit the floor.
Yeah.
Blood's probably going to come out of his ears and mouth, but that's it.
So, Snake now definitely on board with this whole plan that he never wanted to be part of anyway.
Super pissed.
Hops in a small glider and takes off.
And this is all for a pardon of all of his crimes.
A pardon of all of his crimes and being set free back into society. So
his days of tearing tags off of mattresses. So we'll finally forgive you.
Now, as you watch this scene, you'll see Snake flies into the city. And they actually built a model city of New York for this. But you'll see on Snake's screen, there's like a 3D line drawings of like where he's flying through. Actually, 3D imaging was actually too expensive for him to afford. John Carpenter had a $7 million budget for this film, couldn't afford the 3D processing of the time to make that, so they actually painted the whole models black and put reflective tape on all of it in like geometric shapes so that it looked like it was a 3D model, and then just put the camera through. I just thought that was a pretty cool effect because I didn't notice it. Like, I thought it was legit shitty 80s graphics.
When you're paying Jimmy Cameron to paint your fucking background.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
going to
look good.
It's going to cost a lot. Yeah.
I got a friend who deals in props, and every once in a while, like, storyboards come up from camera movies, and I'm like, what if these like storyboards were actually done by Cameron? Because I know he actually did the storyboards for Aliens.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't know if he did them for all of his other movies, but I'm thinking that's a little fucking piece of artwork that Jim Cameron might have actually put his fingers to. That's fucking awesome to me. So.
Also, another interesting scene. A lot of the sets and stuff that were used in this movie were repurposed for another movie the next year, Blade Runner. So
hard to believe.
A lot of all this stuff was just repainted and reused for the movie Blade Runner. So
I would like to
cool.
just add something here that I wrote down that I'm going to read, that he refuses to call him Snake. He says, call me Snake. Never calls him that. He calls him Pliskin the entire time. This is like when a friend of yours decides they want to have a nickname and they start telling people to call them that, and you're like, I'm not fucking calling you that, dude.
Yeah.
However,
you don't choose a nickname.
You
the
don't.
Nickname is chosen for
it
you.
It chooses you, yes.
I'm not calling you Loretta. So,
I learned that the hard way. When I went to Salisbury University, they asked it. Was like, I joined the rugby team. Like, anybody got any nicknames or something? And I was like, I mean, I had a legit nickname already from high school. Mm-hmm. People called me Easy or Eazy-E. And I was like, yeah, people call me Easy and stuff like that. They were like, haha, more like fucking lazy, faggot. That was the first words that were said to me when I tried to present that I had a nickname
my
already.
My best friend's younger brother introduced himself to a new friend of ours. Our friend's name was Bean.
Ooh.
And then he introduced himself as Boss Dog. And we all turned around and we were like, since fucking when?
Boss Dog?
So then we changed it. We would call him Boss Frog, Boss Hog. Anything else, and he would get so mad. But you know what? To this day, his sister calls him Boss Dog. It's like stuck.
It's like the sister from Ferris Bueller. But my friends call me Shauna. So
my friend Toad, which is already a pretty cool nickname, used to have another nickname, and it was Buff, which stood for beautiful, ugly, fat fuck. Which I thought was nice and mean at the same time.
I want to read this, but before I do, I would just like to say that my favorite nickname is not really a nickname. It's just what they call a character in a movie from Mystery Science Theater 3000. Every time he's on screen and running, they just say things like Beef McThickstrong. And that's just my favorite fucking thing ever. I said this though, if you're gonna kill a man with capsule core explosions that burst open both major arteries, you can at least have the decency to call him Snake.
Yeah
I feel like, come
on, little respect.
Have some fucking respect,
you know. It's 2017, you know. I can't imagine in
or
this
18 it doesn't matter
it 2018 whatever, you know. we can't even get people's nicknames right. How do you think we're gonna get pronouns right? Okay, you got to do baby steps with us, people.
Look, you're gonna get a gender fluid get out if you keep talking like this.
So Snake hops in this plane, flies through the city, and has to do a landing on top of the World Trade Center. And he gets the World Trade Center. He lands on top and almost falls off the top, but luckily, like, throws some little spikes out of the back that just keep it from like dangling off the edge.
The Batman spikes.
Probably the best landing at the World Trade Center. We can say that, right? Like, that is the best one that we've had, right?
Comparatively speaking.
In the history of the three total that I know of.
I know.
The other two were real bad.
I know that, wow. I know I know that 9/11 happened after this movie takes place, but it's like still like too soon, buddy.
Was it too soon? Too soon. I'm sorry.
Not an airplane.
You know,
it's a glider.
I thought about it and I was like, maybe should I take the 9/11 joke out of here?
Never.
And I was like, no, it isn't. Listen, this is a fictional movie.
Hey, buddy, what is this show about? It's about two things, time and quality.
Yeah. And okay. The fact that jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams. So let's not act like they took it down.
Let's not err from that, yeah.
So anyway, Snake then goes down and hits the streets. He takes his machine gun, which is his machine gun he's rolling around with is literally an Uzi with a giant silencer and also a fucking deer scope on top of it. Like, this gun makes no sense at all. Like, nobody's aiming with an Uzi. Uzi's made for spraying lots of bullets.
It's
places.
White people shit.
Yeah. But you can't hit something with a 9mm. 9mm doesn't go that far, bro. Like, you're not fucking
what
taking shit.
What if he constantly
out.
Had a black circle around his eye where he kept trying to look through the scope and it kept cocking back into his face every time he pulled the trigger?
Yeah, it's just the little joke from the people back at the island. They put like a little ring on it, so he walks around. He's just like, that dumbass has a patch on his eye and a fucking circle. What a jackass. People just keep coming up to him. He's like, what's going on, PDI? PDI is the thing from the Little Rascals.
I got that.
Petey. Okay,
yeah.
Sweet.
Petey.
That's a pit bull, by the way.
So he, they weren't all monsters.
Mad love.
So,
and that's how all the Little Rascals died on set.
Damn it, Jeremy.
As they were mauled in the neck by Petey 1, 2, 4, and 5.
So, we need a new Petey. They keep killing a kid every week. God damn it. Why do we have to write this goddamn dog into the fucking scenes?
So he picks up the tracker and he starts. He sees that at the wreckage of Air Force One, the president is nowhere to be found. He starts using the tracking beacon that the Game Boy that's essentially attached to the president. And he starts following it, which leads him to a theater. And these fellas are doing... a great full-on drag show in this theater. And we see Ernest Borgnine, who plays the character Cavi. He's
really enjoying
the show.
He's
the only one that's fucking loving it. This fucking poor autistic man is just up front row like, yeah, this is great. I really love the shows. You know, they say prison is tough, but this is not hard time.
I'm enjoying masturbating to this like none other.
His name would be Ernest. Like, when you see somebody like that making a face like that to that kind of show, and you're like, what's your name? Ernest? Yeah, but oh, I'd like to, before he gets to this, before he meets Ernest, who loves drag shows, there's a scene where punks are attempting to rape a...
it happens right after this.
Okay.
He goes down into the steps, and Cabby warns him and says, oh, Mr. Snake, you shouldn't go down there. It's pretty dangerous. And it's literally, the whole downstairs is just filled with nothing but mostly rapists. Yeah. It's just a den of rape.
Pretty much.
Down there.
That's a rape basement.
Yeah, it's a rape dungeon. But it's fucking bad.
Okay, he sees, and she's like, okay, to the listener, calm down. She is clearly drugged, and they don't show you if she took drugs voluntarily or if whatever, but she clearly is like kind of unconscious. They're kind of passing her around. Like, you see someone rip her shirt open. You surmise that rape is going to happen. You don't see it, which I'm thankful for.
Doesn't look consensual.
Because my parents won't let me watch movies with sex in it.
It's not
but,
that death wishy.
So he doesn't. He sees this and he thinks to himself, you know what? I'm going to move on. I'm not gonna engage. This is the kind of stuff that happens here every day. Who the fuck am I?
It was the 90s. Right? You know what? You didn't get involved with that kind of stuff. Let's be honest.
Well, I mean, come on. If you dress like someone who's been raped, you probably were. So then somebody comes up to him and they're like, hey, nice boots. Remember? And then he's like, hey, those are really nice boots. And somebody comes out and tries to grab him. So he will defend boots. Yeah. Will not attempt to stop rape.
Not at all. Not at all. I also love his Zuma pants that he's chosen to go take into battle. He's like, God, I got to go do some hard time. Which one am I going to... You know what? Pick the Motley Crue specials. Mm-hmm, throw those on. That way, when you're in prison with all these badasses, they'll know you're legit. I thought the spandex was a fun choice. That's all I'm saying. Now, he does come across where he finally sees the tracker. He can see the arm. And it's just some dude who's just punching who he thinks is the president in the face over and over and over and over again. And it looks like the guy couldn't be enjoying it more because he kicks the guy off him and he turns around. And Jeremy, I couldn't find this audio, but I feel like you could do a solid impersonation of this homeless gentleman who's wearing the president's
tracker. I'm pretty sure it's the same guy who's not only in They Live.
No, he's the guy in They Live who goes, he's like, that's it. You just want to be on the winning team.
And
yes,
and
that guy.
Also, wasn't he the bum in Back to the Future?
I'm not sure on that one, but I see his face and he might be. He might be.
I'm trying to look up the other bum that was in the basement because I recognize him from other movies as
well. Jerry, do you think you can give me the line that homeless man gives Snake? You can ad lib it.
Sure.
I feel like you could do it. I feel like you have his essence.
He's getting punched in the face.
They say if I put this thing on, I'm the president.
Nailed it.
That was as close as
we
could get.
We knew we could trust
that
him with
that.
That
was as close as we could get.
Now put these glasses on.
Yeah. So he... Snake then picks up the walkie-talkie and informs Hulk that the president is probably dead. Hulk tells Snake that if he takes off with that glider, he will shoot him down, and he's got 18 hours, Plissken. So Snake walks down the street and finds the president's pod. President isn't in the pod either, though.
His name is George Buckflower, by the way.
Thank you for that. So, as he takes the load off, he tries to ponder his current situation. Then all of a sudden, he sees a rack of inmates starting to come out of the woodworks, through the sewers, out of the alleyways, almost like Night of the Living Dead. Almost like they're mutants, pretty much.
And
pretty
I'm cool. Dancing with myself.
So, he retreats back into a diner, and he walks in and finds a woman who seems to recognize him as Snake Plissken, and she is down to fuck.
And, of course, is his real-life wife at the time.
Yes. This is actually...
Let me go back.
This is one of two married couples in this movie, John Carpenter and Adrienne Barbeau, who are married at the time, that are soon to be exes.
And
and Kurt Russell, and her name is Season Hubley. Season Hubley.
That's ridiculous, and I refuse to accept it.
And I did look up George Buckflower, who is in Back to the Future.
Crazy drunk drivers.
It is him. All right, of course. Jeremy, this is why we have you on the show. Things like that.
I can't believe he's still alive.
This and only this.
The inmates, all of a sudden, right when she's leaning in for a kiss, start breaking literally through the floorboards. One pops up through the floorboards. The other one, another part of the floor, breaks away and drags that girl into there. And all of a sudden, they start coming out of the fucking woodworks and like surrounding this little diner he's in. So Snake makes a break for it, unloads a couple shots, decides to go up, climbs out a window, climbs up the fucking fire escape to the next one. Shoves a bookcase in front of the window. A guy's hand comes out. He blows his hand off, which is pretty badass. Then he turns around, and I think this is the first time I'd ever seen this in a movie. I've seen it replicated multiple times, but he takes the machine gun and basically shoots a machine gun circle in the wall and then jumps through the wall to get out of that room.
It's like the cartoon thing with the saw in the floor.
Yeah. But I think it's the first time in cinema that I can recall that ever being done.
It's very original.
And then he crawls out the other side, goes and hits the ground floor back to the alley, and then starts booking it, breaks his radio in the process.
Damn it.
And then all of a sudden at the end of the alleyway, it's none other but his good friend Cabby going, "Hey Snake, why don't you get in this ride at a very convenient time?" And he tells him it's a real dangerous, and he just rolls around with Molotov cocktails.
The coolest conversation that's ever happened, because he casually explains, like, "Man, you do not want to be in this area. This is a bad area." While he in the car is lighting a Molotov cocktail. Yes, like, wait, the area is bad. And he just chucks it into the alleyway where punks are running towards him. Totally alleviates the situation with fire. That's a best friend right there.
It's pretty dope. It's pretty dope. You know what? 5-star Uber rating immediately. Like, for real. Like, that's a good Uber driver who carries Molotov cocktails, who will block a gang of people that are chasing you in pursuit.
Not the best music, but ultimate security.
Hell yeah.
Okay. So the other bum that actually that he talks to in the basement, that he's like, "Hey, of course," that he comes up on it. Did you recognize that other bum?
No, I didn't recognize the other bum.
He's also the bum from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, like, "Jimmy Catcorn, I don't care." This is like ultimate bum roles in movies. It's like, wow, you got so stereotyped. You got the best movies.
I love that there's all this bum opportunities that are happening. Now, as they're driving away, Cabby informs him that he knows where the president is. He's like, "Of course, the Duke of NY has him." So, Cabby takes him to meet the Brain, who has access to Duke. Goes basically to what looks like a giant municipal building, knocks on the front door, and Maggie answers. And Maggie is played by none other than Adrienne Barbeau, who did the intro to this show. Very
love
big
her.
Ups, Adrienne Barbeau. We got to meet
many
her. She's
times.
Very, very fun.
Love her as the snake charming lady in Carnival.
Yeah, you know, my favorite Adrienne Barbeau movie is her role in Creepshow. I like her as Billy because
I thought you were going to say Swamp Thing. So
I don't mind her in Swamp Thing, but she's such a grade A cunt in that movie in Creepshow. Like, I've never there's never been a more unlikable woman than her in Creepshow.
And no good in bed, Henry.
Oh, look at you. Let me clean you up there, Henry.
Always drunk and obnoxious. So.
What would I do without you, Billy? And the fact that she's named Billy, she's such a horrible person. So Snake walks in after he gains access because I'll let you know, Adrienne Barbeau is in her full chested prime in this film. And the top of her curliness
is
perm.
Awesome.
Like, her rag is fully out in this movie.
Like, if you were breastfeeding and having trouble making milk, you could just watch this movie.
Yeah.
And it would just help you.
I my breasts got bigger watching her.
Watching this movie made me lactate.
So Snake recognizes the Brain as a gentleman from his past, Harold Hellman. So Harold is played by Harry Dean Stanton, famous
Repo Man,
which is the second movie we've gone over with Harry Dean Stanton. Of course, we did the Alien episode not too far back. Some people might know him as the creepy fucking child molesty preacher from the show Big Love. That's among the Repo Man in other films.
He's one of those guys that's got that face where you go, oh, I've seen, oh, what's his name? I've fucking seen him 1,000 times. Yeah, yeah. It's one of those dudes.
Repo Man spends his time getting into trouble.
So we find out that the Brain has fucked Snake in Kansas City years ago. There's basically a heist, and he left him and his partner for dead there. And oddly enough, there's a deleted scene from this movie that actually shows how Snake gets arrested, but they don't necessarily say that this is the Kansas City job. But it's actually a really cool scene. If you've never seen it, you can look it up on YouTube. Look for Escape from New York deleted scene. It's really actually pretty good. It establishes Snake actually had a friend at one time and actually looked out for, probably cared about somebody. Mm-hmm. And they rob a bank and escape on the metro. And it basically ends in his friend getting fucking pulverized by gunfire in front of him. Nice. When he's telling his friend, just put it down, man. Put the case down. Mm. They got us. And he doesn't listen and gets fucking
blasted. It makes
sense
because when he's talking to the dude at the desk who's giving him his mission, and at the end of that conversation he says something to him about like, well, I know because you don't care about anybody, and they kind of hold the camera on him and he looks hurt. Yeah. Like he's like,
it establishes something about Snake's character in the deleted scene that I feel like in this movie he's like a full almost anarchist, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But now it like he has a heart when you watch this deleted scene.
It's a shame they deleted it.
I would suggest everybody watch it. It's about an 8-minute deleted clip that you can watch on YouTube. I feel it really adds. You can watch it right before you start the movie because it is okay. In the very beginning. So definitely check it out.
Can I say why I think the Brain is so intelligent?
Yes, please.
Because I think the scene sets up that he's actually drilling oil right in the middle of the library inside there, which that I think that just takes the genius. So you know.
I didn't pick that up at all.
There's oil refining going on in the actual building.
And that's good use of books. So,
and I watched There Will Be Blood, so that's really hard to do through all that, you know, all those streets. So,
he gets the Brain. He basically gets the Brain to help him out by offering him a way out on the glider. And while the Brain is hesitant, he ultimately agrees because Snake basically says he's going to blow his fucking head off if he doesn't. And Adrian Barbeau is just like, do it. I think he's serious. So. Yeah. His badassness wins this round. They go out and hit the streets shortly after that, but as they walk outside, they can hear the rumble of Duke's car coming. So the Duke of New York is coming, and it's a pretty fucking badass scene because this motherfucker
chandeliers on a Cadillac.
Yeah, he's so the Duke is played by Isaac Hayes, and
it is.
He's a good old chef from South Park, and he's riding in a 77 Cadillac Fleetwood that has fucking chandeliers mounted above the headlights in a very has to be problems with sight of vision.
And this is
like
before Pimp My Ride.
Yeah, yeah. This is a real fucking pimp ass ride.
Who is the man who puts chandeliers on his fucking car and doesn't care about your feelings?
The Duke
of New York. Yeah.
So I like that too. If you were the leader of the biggest city in America that is now a prison,
the Duke is a bad mother. Shut your mouth.
That you choose the title Duke. You know, I just don't.
Did you guys watch that clip I sent you of Aqua Teen Hunger Force?
Yeah.
God, I love that. When the camera zooms in, he goes, "I'm just a what, bitch?" That's my favorite.
So since they see that the Duke's here, Snake urges Brain to take him to where the president is because now they know Duke is away. He was like, "We ain't got no wheels, Snake." He was like, "We're never going to make it there in time. If he's here now," he was just like, "I'll get us a car." So they commandeer one of the cars in the entourage, which is a badass station wagon. It's all metaled out. It's like
reinforced for zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, it looks pretty fucking metal. And then they decide to try to beat the Duke back home. And they decide to go through a little rough neighborhood to do that. And by rough neighborhood, it's literally... I don't understand this, but there's literally hundreds of people outside with bricks ready to fuck this car up as it drives through their neighborhood. So the cars just get pelted by bricks. Hundreds of people jumping in front of the car. He's running over people. Bricks after bricks after bat.
Obviously,
after bat.
This is this movie's MLK Boulevard.
Yes. This is exactly what it is. But they get to the end of the street, and all of a sudden, there's a giant wall of fucking junked cars that's blocking the way. So Snake pulls a very calm. I have to mention how calm he does this.
Yes,
very calm 3-point turn. Like, it's not like a fancy like, oh, spin around like this. Like, nope, we're gonna do a good solid. Let's look over our shoulders. We'll swing the arm back to look, make sure there's no pedestrians. 3-point turn. Then he slams it in reverse as hard as he can, backs into it, and pushes one of the cars out of the way. It collapses the walls, and now they are in the other part of the town, safe once again.
I like to imagine that when the car came up to the wall of cars, it had an emotional reaction like the soldiers did when they walked up to that wall of bodies in 300.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh my God, those are our cousins.
That was my mother's gremlin. So,
it amazes me how many people I've actually met from this movie.
Oh, yeah?
It's kind of disturbing because the one thing, I met Borgnine a couple of years ago.
And is Borgnine still alive? Is he still kicking?
No, he died in like a year or two after I met him. But,
oh, Borgnine doesn't kick.
The Jeremy Woodworth curse.
Yeah, you meet me, then you die. So
I met John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. And
then I met Martin Luther King.
Meeting Jeremy is the equivalent of watching like the Ring tape.
It's like the word gets out to celebrities like, you don't want to meet this guy. You're going to die. So anyway, I met him. And of course, I didn't realize he was with his actual wife, who's much more attuned and a little bit younger, maybe by 10 years. And of course, I commented to him like, yeah, and I'm also a big fan of Merlin's Mystical Shop of Wonders, which is an MST3K movie, which was pretty hilarious. And of course, his wife got a good chuckle from that, like, oh, mention that movie.
Nice. So the brain tells Snake that he's got 4 minutes to get in there and get out with the president before Duke returns. And basically, the president's being held at like a train station within one of the train cars. There's a bunch of Duke's guys right outside of the train. So the brain and Maggie, who's Adrienne Barbeau, walk over to cause a little bit of a distraction, and they're just kind of shooting the shit, and Brain's trying to throw away around that he's important to the Duke and blah 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 blah. Meanwhile, Snake is infiltrating and getting inside of the cabin, and when he does, you get to see that the president isn't getting treated very nicely inside of here. He's getting real beat up inside of this place. They put a wig on him.
Like a lady's wig.
They're slapping him around a little bit like he's a little bitch. And I found out this little tidbit about this. Donald Pleasance said that he drew inspiration for this role because at one time he was actually a prisoner of fucking war during World War II.
No shit.
Yeah, yeah. He was part of the British Royal Air Force. I might be messing this up. I'm doing it partly for memory.
Whatever it was, Albert Fish was in it.
And I question how much of it actually was getting into the role in the Great Escape, where he was actually in a war camp.
Yeah.
Just like in real life. I never knew in real life he was in a war camp.
Yeah, so in real life he flew over 66 missions over Axis. Wow. Over Axis controlled Europe, and got shot down over Germany, and was being held at a camp where, oddly enough, can you guess what his job was at the camp? It was to put on theater productions for the Germans.
Oh my God.
I shit you not.
I bet I know what they looked like.
Yeah. So they were like, you know what? We see in Germany, we know how to put all people to work that aren't Jews. And you, sir, clearly have a niche for acting. You will put on greatest German plays for us every day. Sieg Heil die Führer. So just another interesting tidbit about Donald Pleasance that I didn't know. I found through the research of this episode. But as Snake...
Good job, Puma Man.
So Snake slips in. He throws a knife into the fucking forehead of this guy. Fucking kills him real quick. Slips away with the president. But as he's slipping away out the back, the Duke's men show up. And right around the corner is the brain and Maggie. He's been fucked by a second time by him. The Duke comes over, he starts to question him, grabs an arrow that's in his leg and starts moving it around a little bit on him. And the brain tells him, he's like, that's Snake Plissken. We might need him as a bargaining chip. And he goes, dude comes up to him and he goes, I thought you were dead. And he gets that a lot of people. And yeah. In fact, I think that's a line from an old John Wayne movie that they wanted to incorporate in this. Oddly enough, every character that says, I thought you were dead to Snake, ends up dead themselves. So,
I didn't notice that.
Spoiler alert.
Oh my God. Ahead.
Adrian Barbeau says it. So does, what's his name?
Duke.
And so does Duke. And I believe... Borg does it. All those people die. So
if there's one thing that this movie does miss, I wish that he'd hid under a box at one point.
Yeah, get under a box. Yeah, I mean, we haven't gotten into just the inspiration, but yes, the game Metal Gear Solid is very heavily inspired by this. It's Solid Snake. This is Snake Plissken. They both have an eye patch. They both live in post-apocalyptic futures. They're both specially trained agents for the state.
I get it. It's very inspiring. It's when fun. I fill out a questionnaire and it says religion, I put Escape from New York. I get it. Who's to judge?
So Snake gets stripped down and back at the gang's hideout, you get to see his cool fucking Cobra Commander chest tattoo that he has.
Yeah.
He's surrounded by guards with crossbows and spears, which, like, dude, you're taking your job mad seriously when you're standing right over top of him with the crossbow.
Yeah.
You have a projectile, dude.
Right.
Like, chill.
Right.
Chill out and give him some space.
Back.
So the Duke is firing Snake's gun around the president. Like, the president is meanwhile tied up to a wall and he's shooting the gun around him. And everybody seems to just think, this is the funniest thing in the whole world.
It's one thing to kidnap the president. It's a whole other thing to fucking have disrespect.
Yeah. Respect the seat, if nothing else. Respect the office. In the process of while he's doing that, he actually shoots open the case to reveal a cassette that falls out of it. And his secondhand man, the dude with the crazy Billy Idol hair, picks it up and puts it in his pocket.
So bad I want it to be a floppy disk. I always want it to be a floppy disk.
Now, are you talking about the big one?
The big one.
The legit floppies?
Really, any. As long as it was in a movie, it's fine. Okay. I would say. Or like a zip disk. Whatever. Whenever there's like some kind of something that they have to get to and it's got all the information, I always want it to be a floppy disk.
100 megabytes?
I know.
Oh my god!
You get like 200 floppies
on
this thing.
What in the world?
I just want to redo the movie where it drops out and it says ultimate date mixtape on the label.
Yes.
I love any movie where a computer is involved and they do the thing where they're waiting for something to load while someone's walking slowly over to them that they don't want them to see it, and they go, come on, come on, come on. That's my favorite.
So they take the case and then they put it out in the open, and the chopper sees it and lands to go pick it up, and it is now filled with the Duke's demands, which is essentially a full pardon for everyone within there to be released in exchange for the president. Hulk decides to send in the troops. Duke's men, meanwhile, take Snake to a boxing ring. The crowd is rabid. Of course, he's thrown into the ring, and he's forced to fight a giant opponent named Slag. And Slag, oddly enough, is played by a professional wrestler named Ox Baker, who actually roughed up Kurt Russell pretty bad in this.
He's
to the point
dude.
where Kurt was like, what the hell, man? Come on, calm down. He had to like tell him to stop. Like, he's like, I'm not a wrestler. Can you stop like literally pummeling me constantly?
I love any story where an LA actor pretty boy is playing the toughest, roughest, scariest dude in the planet. But in real life, he had to be like, stop hitting so hard.
Yes.
God.
Yes. Duke says, we'll be riding to freedom with Snake's head mounted on the roof of my car. I fucking love it. Now, meanwhile, Maggie and the Brain decide to do a very daring rescue of the president. They infiltrate there, and they end up killing Brain's... Brain ends up killing their top guy and three other dudes. So they kill the Billy Idol dude. Now they got the tape. They saved their fucking wig-donning president, who is very British, and now they're out of there. The fight continues on, and it isn't going well for Snake, meanwhile, back in the ring. He's getting beat up real bad, but at the last minute, he moves out of the way and hits fucking Ox right in the back with a death blow of the spiked bat.
Pretty sweet.
It's pretty cool.
It's an escalating scene because it starts with they throw them bats and you hear the clanging of the bats like hitting each other, and then like round two they drop them, go to your corners, then they give them a little metal plate that they can use as armor,
a trash can lid,
and they give them a nail studded bat, and then you know, he hits hits him once in the stomach. It makes him bend over, and he gets him right in the back of the head. And it's like, whoo.
That was fun.
He made it through. Okay, cool.
Now, of course, the president does what we expect him to do, which is as soon as he's released, he takes the blonde wig off. Whereas in my version, he goes through the rest of the movie with the blonde wig, and they're like, Mr. President, you know you can take that off. Oh, no, I enjoyed
this. Oh, I didn't even notice it at all. You know, in my Britishness as an American president, I just didn't even understand why that was a big deal.
I'm going to take it off in front of people.
So right after the fight, though, during the commotion, he sees the tracer that was on Snake's hand, and he actually hits it from the guy who stole it from him. So this signals the people back there that, hey, I'm still alive. Don't call in the troops quite yet. Mm-hmm. They then come in and announce that the president's gone and the brain took him. The room scatters off to go find him. Snake slips off and starts up the long stairs to the top of the World Trade Center.
Am I like the other freaks in the world, like Tommy Simbazo, when they see that moment in the film, think, I want that exact same bracelet with the thing that calls the button because it's so freaking
with the
brass
eagle on
cool.
It.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of dope. Okay, I'll give it to you. Cool. It looks like a belt buckle that like
for your wrist
that a cyberpunk hillbilly would wear.
Yes,
that's the best way to describe
it.
Yes,
it really
a belt
is.
Buckle for my wrists.
Snake works on his cardio, gets all the way to the top to find the president, Maggie, and Brain pinned down by the prisoners as they push the glider off the edge of the building, destroying it. They run back down the steps of the World Trade Center, and they find a car that they want to go commandeer. They try to start it, and it doesn't seem to be working. Why? Because they pop the hood. There's a fucking dude with a crossbow inside of it. Are you shitting? Out of all the... Listen, if you were tracking men, like, never in my wildest dreams would I think, hey, let's go take the... This is going to take him 45 minutes to walk down these steps. Yeah. I timed it. Let's remove the engine. So when he goes to check it, I'm going to crossbow him in the fucking face.
Do you
it's
like to picture
so
like they were all like, as he's coming down, they're all like, stop.
Shut your fucking mouth.
I think it's totally believable because it's like the amazing thing was everything else off the car wasn't completely stripped except the engine. So
yes.
I wish when they popped it open, he would have gone, "Oh, you should have seen your face, stupid."
So, Duke has him surrounded, but is able to distract him a little bit enough that he pulls a gun and then shoots some canisters near the Duke that release some type of gas, which is just enough distraction for them to get away. Seems like kind of bullshit. They're surrounded by people that could
like
literally
the
kill them.
The evilest dude on Evil Island is going... And that's how they got away.
Now, Cabby rescues him once again because outside, Cabby's just been waiting in a fucking car this whole time and could have driven you the entire time. So, this initiates a pretty sweet car chase between them and Duke's caddy following closely behind. They weave through traffic on a bridge. Now, oddly enough, this bridge where this whole sequence was filmed, John Carpenter actually purchased. It was called the Old Chain of Rocks Bridge in St. Louis. He purchased it from the government for $1.
Stop it.
For $1 to film this. And then returned it for him for the exact same amount after the filming was completed.
Wow,
so,
he could have been way more of a dick about that.
He could have been a bridge baron, right?
I would have put two guards at either end dressed as knights and just enjoyed that the rest of my life.
Yeah. So as they're driving through, this is very treacherous. There's cars all over the bridge. Also, there's land fucking mines on the bridge. So Snake actually hits a landmine and blows the car in half, and in doing so, kills Cabby, which is pretty sad. Then the brain goes and takes off. The brain gets fucking blown up by a landmine of his own. So now they're two for two. Well, this kind of infuriates Maggie, because now Maggie's fucking pissed. So she takes her fucking Glock, or she takes her .45 out that also has a hunting scope. Makes no sense. And then starts shooting at the Duke as he's driving up, and in a pretty fucking cool death scene just crashes right fucking into her. And I watched it multiple times. I was like, they had to just actually killed Adrienne Barbeau right there. I mean, there's no other...
One titty flew one way. Yeah. One titty flew the other way.
I didn't even think that after her body's crushed there that her breast would have been deflated with just...
Yeah, dude, you think they would have popped like she was a tube of toothpaste and just those titties went boop.
What a horrible thing to think. But that's the way I think, because I'm a man.
And that's where J.J. Abrams came in, because that scene was added of her showing her dead body, because he's like, we're not really sure if she's dead. I mean,
he's
but
right.
I watched that crash, and I was just like, there's no part that said, yeah, she's probably all
right. Right. Well, he's a teenager, so he's like, is she dead, or?
Maybe she could be pinned between it, and they could have a nice little talk, like in the Mel Gibson film. So.
Yeah.
You know what, though? I got to say, like, between this and Alien and a lot of other movies that came out around this time period, they really don't hold back on letting the chicks be
women
awesome.
Women were badass
women
in the 80s.
Women were badass in the 80s, absolutely. And when she dies, it's totally a soldier's death.
And then the 90s, they all go back to being Renee Zellweger.
Exactly. It's annoying. Like, fucking Jennifer Aniston, suck my dick. You know, like, I have perfect hair.
She fought
but
a
no,
leprechaun, though.
Yeah, I have perfect hair, but no spine. Like, you're the worst person ever.
That is
like,
true.
Because, okay, that's her dude, they keep flip-flopping on their loyalty. They keep going with them, but then they betray them, but then they go with them, and then they betray them. And then she, Brain, dies, and she is literally in shock. Like, he's like, we gotta go. And you see her kind of blank out, but then you figure out that she's got something churning in her fucking head. She looks at him, and she's like, I fucking got it, dude. And he knows what that means. Man to man, what that means on the battlefield is, you go, I'm going to stall them by shooting at them and creating a barricade of chaos, and it's going to give you a little more time. I know I'm going to die, but it's for the cause. And she does. She fucking shoots the shit out of that car. It runs right into her. She dies instantly, and he got the time he needed to get away. It's fucking awesome.
It was pretty awesome.
And all in a leotard.
God bless
her.
God bless
her. You know?
We give it up for Adrian Barbeau, everybody.
That's fucking
Adrian
awesome.
Fucking Barbeau.
2020. Let's do it.
So the president is runs for the wall. He runs for the wall, which, let's be honest, he probably built that wall. Anyway, I thought it was a pretty good joke. So they throw down a rope pulley system and hoist the president up. He is now safe and sound. Snake is now waiting for the rope, but old Duke is caught up to him, and he starts unleashing gunfire on him. So Snake makes a run for it. Now Duke runs over to try to go grab the rope. Snake gets the drop on him. They have a little skirmish. Snake easily bests him in this fight that they have on the ground. He goes back for the rope, but this time they stop him as Snake's being hoisted up. This is enough time for Duke to get the gun again, and he's about to shoot him, but the president comes back over and does his best Scarface impersonation. He goes, "You motherfuckers!"
For real. He's still mad about the wig.
Yeah, you put a wig on me, and I am a British American gentleman who doesn't take this.
He corrects himself.
Much like Jean-Luc Picard, who is actually British and French.
Yeah, French something. I don't know. And he gets Snake back up and lets Snake back up to the top. And he goes, anything for you, Snake, after what you've done. You've saved me as the president. And next, pulls him up to the top and hands him the tape, and that's pretty much it.
His balls couldn't drop any further. The president was just like, "Dude, you're the fucking man."
Yeah, gives him basically ready to give him the keys to the city.
Yeah, but to this one, he's like, "Please take my wife. Like, please take it."
Yeah, he's ready to have a cuck situation with him right after this. So Pliskin then talks to the president in one of the closing scenes of the movie, and Snake asks him about, what about all the people that died trying to help you escape? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, well, we'll make sure that we thank them, and the American people thank him, and stuff like that. And Snake looks at him like, this motherfucker.
Well, because he knows. He's like, you're corrupt anyway.
This motherfucker.
And he's kind
of
dismissive. He's like getting his neck, his like beard shaved, like hot cream shave.
Yeah.
And he's like looking in the mirror like, yeah, we'll thank them. I mean,
by the way, my wife's commented on what a shitty job this person was doing shaving the president.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
This is supposed to be a presidential barber. This is not a good job that he's doing at all.
Very
anyway.
Patchy.
Snake walks away in disgust, has one little interaction with Hulk. He says, he's like, you know, Snake, we'd make a hell of a team. And he answers, call me Pliskin. It just doesn't matter because he's that badass. He doesn't want him to call him Snake now. He's going to call him Snake. You'll call me Pliskin.
I liked to imagine that he really fought hard for the Snake thing and it didn't take. And now he's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm Pliskin and I'm over it. I'm not Snake anymore. I don't care.
So, oh, I also failed to mention that they deactivate the explosives in his neck, also with like 2 seconds left.
Thank you.
Kind of forgot that part.
I think they used bulk erasers, too.
Yeah, it literally was just these two things. It was just like they stick on his neck. All right, you're good to go. And he looks at the timer and... Oh, good. I'm glad my neck didn't explode.
It literally
That's cool.
takes more to change my oil at Jiffy Lube.
Yeah. So the president then addresses the cameras and, you know, he's like, I'm sorry I couldn't be there at the summit. But with this tape, I'm hoping that we can finally find a peace in this world. And
all the nations.
He puts it in there and it's actually it's Cabby's tape that's in there. It's,
he switched
it's
the
big,
tape.
It's big band music that starts playing. It's big band music.
The special scientist information from Thorn Industries. That's going to help save the world. Yeah. So.
And you know what? Still less embarrassing than the Bush presidency.
So
that's a fact.
Yeah, and then it shows Snake walking off, and he takes the tape and he rips it up and just destroys it. Basically, this is the ending of the movie. He started World War III was what the ending of this movie was, yeah. Which is pretty fucking metal.
Well, he's alive. He's got a pardon on all his crimes. He fucking nailed it saving the president. So it's like Snake is that guy. He's like, yeah, I fucking did. I achieved all these things. Fuck you.
I do have one last little special thing to share with you guys.
I'm excited.
This is actually an alternate ending I found for the movie. It's pretty good. To me, I thought this would have been a better ending than what they decided to go with.
How many are there?
There's lots of alternate endings, but this one is the best alternate ending I found. So here, this is Donald Pleasant. He's addressing the cameras and is about to put in the tape. So check this out.
You're on camera, Mr. President.
Good evening. Although I shall not be present at this historic summit meeting, I present this in the hope that our great nations may learn to live in peace.
I'm a Scatman. And his fucking face too is so that perfect.
That was just a much better ending to the film. You know, the 1997 hit song The Scatman comes and plays on. It saves the world. There's no longer a World War III.
I was
and
really
disaster.
Hoping for some Slayer.
Some Slayer. Oh, Jeremy, you know, they all can't be winners. But that's it. That's our show, folks.
Oh,
that is
God.
Escape from New York, man.
I'm going to say, so far, one of my favorite movies that we've reviewed.
I do. I love this.
I fucking love this movie.
I'm a big John Carpenter fan, and this is one of my favorite John Carpenter movies. It was just a joy rewatching this. Like, this is some movies that we go through, like Six Ring Samurai. I have to sit through and really power through to take notes on this. Yeah. And I transcribe every episode. So, all these notes that you're hearing of how the movie breaks down, this is Eric stopping and pausing the movie and typing out what he's watching and stuff like that so that we can move the show along in a. This one is an. It would be about 90 minutes, but you know, this one was a joy to watch. I really enjoyed it.
I would love to note that John Carpenter is very Carpenter as a director is not really, I would say, it today fully appreciated for how he designs the look of a scene. Like, there are a lot of like Hitchcock influences where he puts like shadows that are very like cutting that create lines when they walk up. Snake through one of the scenes, there's like these two red pillars that are cut to look like the top of lipstick almost, and they're like put in the middle of the scene, and then behind that are like these clearly cut to be shaped in a certain way, so when the shadow hits it, it's got this very 80s hard lines, and like it's not, they don't force you to see it, but just the way it's designed, it's so beautiful. Like
it is
as a scene.
Well, Carpenter's is a great director in general.
Yeah.
I like the fact that he scores his whole movies.
Yeah.
I like his directing style is, I would say, if I ever get to direct a movie, I think you'll find that my greatest influence will be him and you know, fucking
Drew Barrymore. Obviously.
Drew Barrymore, the other greatest director of our time. Yeah. I mean, clearly. So, and also this did spawn a sequel eventually in the 90s. They also had Escape from LA, which, you know, it's not as critically acclaimed as this movie, yeah, for sure. But I personally like Escape from LA.
I think it's
a neat movie.
Fun movie.
I like it a lot.
I had the choice to watch this one or LA the first time I was introduced to these movies through Netflix. Mm-hmm. I chose LA because I knew the scenery was going to be better.
Yeah.
Like more colorful. The palm trees would be warmer. Mm-hmm. But overall, this one is just hands down way better.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it just inspired a lot of, I think, a lot of other things that came from this, whether it be video games, media, and stuff like that. This view of the dystopian city future hellscape that we could all live in.
Yes.
I think, you know, it probably inspired a lot more kids growing up in the 80s. So
yeah. The fact that this movie is at least 20 years before we actually enclosed New York as a giant prison. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So ahead of its time. Very Shakespearean in that way.
Still the only place you can make it in comedy, though, apparently.
what does that tell you about comedy? Like, how right? sad is that?
Right? hey, Kimberly, where can people find you?
Hey, you can find me on Twitter at WatchMeDoinThis, on Instagram at PanicAtTheDeli, and the second Saturday shit show at the Auto Bar is free. The second Saturday of every month. We're going to have a spectacular special for Father's Day this year. It's going to be super great.
All right. Yeah. Make sure you check out Kim. You can check out all things Eric Comedy at ericcomedy.com. Eric with a K, comedy with a C. We got a big show coming up at the DC Improv on April 11th. You can check that out. Tickets are still available, but they're going to get sold out. Hop on Stitcher and iTunes so you can give us a 5-star rating. We can read it on the show. Thank you. Have a wonderful night, Jeremy.
You can find me at Woodlawn working on my dungeon. It's funny because I actually slowed it down so it almost sounds legit. Like.